Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Look, we're wasting our time here. We should be out there looking for this guy. We're only here to help.
Bunch of pencil pushers and accountants. How are you going to help?
Rizzo.
I'm sorry?
Hey, what's with you? You need a hug or something?
Day player on this early Sunday morning on 720 WGN. So Joe Mantegna has been added in the theater, the movies, and on television for nearly five decades. Joe is currently wrapping up his ninth season as FBI agent David Rossi in CBS's Criminal Minds. He's also known as the voice of Fat Tony on The Simpsons for over 25 years. And Joe was behind the legendary Chicago play The Bleacher Bums, which he and Chicago's Dennis Franz starred in when it debuted in 1977. Now, Joe has always held on to his Chicago roots, and although Joe lives on the West Coast, he's a true Chicagoan at heart, and he's also passionate about food here and the Chicago Cubs. He owns a restaurant in Burbank with his wife called Taste Chicago, and joining us tonight is Chicago's very own Joe Mantegna. Hey, pal.
How you doing, David?
You know, born and raised in Chicago, you went to high school in Cicero, DePaul University. You've never lost your Chicago roots.
You know, it's tough to lose your Chicago roots. They run very deep, I think.
I think so, too.
I mean, it's funny. When we used to, there's a few of us that used to hang out quite a bit out here in Los Angeles. Among them, our dear departed friend Dennis Farina, Dennis Franz, myself, Jack Wallace, J.J. Johnson, a lot of old Chicago alumni. And we used to say when we'd all get together, we would always imagine that the Wrigley Building would start to appear or something.
That's great.
Too much convolution of energy from Chicago in one place. In a way, that's why we opened the restaurant. But it's, it'll always be my hometown. I'm still a, you know, diehard Chicagoan, and I'm proud to have tips of beat it.
I was going to say, there's a West Coast transplant group that gets together, and I know you're part of that, too, where you get it. What is that called again?
Well, they do a thing. They call it Windy City West.
Right.
That's happened at various times over the last, for probably 30 years. Every once in a while, it pops up. It used to do it annually, then it started to just happen randomly. What the good thing is, by opening this restaurant, which we did, it's almost about 12 years ago now, it's afforded a place to do like a mini version of it almost every week.
It's a refuge.
Almost every Friday by clockwork from about 12 noon to 3 o'clock at our restaurant, there'll be these, you know, different groups, people from Chicago, one core group of Chicago actors, and then other people certainly have joined since. And so it's kind of a way of just bringing back the hometown there. And we've got the Italian beef and the deep. We got your Polish, your Chicago dog, your deep dish, and all that stuff. And
I love
the
that.
Jerseys of all the Chicago sports stars hanging in there. So it's kind of our way of duplicating the Windy City here in Los Angeles.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, you got your start here, obviously, in Chicago. You grew up here. How did you first get the acting bug?
You know, I got it really when I went to high school at Morton East High School in Cicero, because up to that point, I don't think I really had any inclination to be an actor. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't grow up with it. There was nobody in my family pointing me toward it. But it was one of those things where I was enraptured with the film West Side Story as a kid, just like many of us were, because growing up in the West Side of Chicago was very much similar to growing up in the West Side of New York.
And
I can relate to that movie. It was this fantasy musical film. Well, when Morton East decided to do that play, they had the tryouts at our high school. I didn't even know it was a play. I just thought, well, this was a movie I've seen many, many times, but I didn't know there's a play based on it. Mm-hmm. So basically on a dare, I tried out for that play. And to make a long story short, I didn't get cast. I did the audition, did not get cast in the play, but was so taken by the experience of trying out for that play, I said to myself, I want to pursue this. There's something about this excites me. And I really haven't looked back from that night trying out for that play at Morton East High School, you know, at 16 years old.
It gave you a rush.
It gave me a rush, and that was 50 years ago.
Wow. Well, you know, backing up a bit, you also touched a little bit in music. You were playing bass, and I found this fact very interesting.
Yeah.
In The Missing Links, tell folks about what The Missing Links was all about.
I wasn't a member of The Missing Links, but we toured with them. I was in a group called The Apocryphals. But The Missing Links ultimately became the group Chicago. And they were dear, very dear friends of ours to this day. I mean, in fact, I just sang this last September that Chicago was playing out here at the Greek Theater, which is this beautiful venue here in Los Angeles. They finally coaxed me to come up on stage and sing a song with them. So we used to tour with them. We toured all over the Midwest, Kentucky, Indiana, Illinois, whatever. And they were a wonderful group of guys, and they ultimately became the band Chicago. We ultimately broke up because we didn't have the talent of the band Chicago. I went on to acting. The other fellows went on to other things, but I stayed close to those guys. And so the Missing Links ultimately became Chicago Transit Authority and then Chicago. They've been one of the most enduring, obviously, rock bands in history.
Now, you were telling me that you tried out for that play in high school. Now, you made your acting debut in 69 in a stage production of Hair. Where was that?
That was at the Schubert Theater, downtown Chicago.
Okay.
They had about four. I was a student at the time at what was then the Goodman School of Drama, which mm-hmm. ultimately became part of DePaul University.
Sure.
Became the theater school at DePaul, which it is today. But I was a student there at the Goodman. I was getting ready to start my third year, and they were having these tryouts for the Broadway musical Hair that they were bringing to Chicago. And about 4,000 young people came and tried out for that play.
Wow.
And I said, well, what the hell? I'm going to give it a shot. You know, and I went in. I had to do six different callbacks. I mean, they kept weeding it down. It went from 4,000 down to ultimately, I think the last callback was about 40 people. And of those 40, they picked 28
wow.
cast members. And I was the 28th person picked. I remember they asked they had all of us on stage at the Schubert, and we did all these little things to audition. And they said, as we call your name, step forward. And if you step forward, you're in the cast of Hair. And they got to 27, and I'm standing there thinking, oh, God. And they said, oh, you, the skinny guy with the black, long black hair, step forward. And then that was that, and that started my career. And ironically, the girl who played Jeannie in that production, who I knew from high school, because she had gone to Morton West High School, and we had done productions, theater productions back then. We see each other, and it's like, hey, you're so-and-so. Oh, you're so-and-so.
Still to this day.
Well, to this day, we've been married ever since.
Oh!
Where we have two children, and so Berger and Jeannie got married, and Arlene and I have been together now going into our 45th year.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, you also did, you had all kinds of other roles between there, but down the road in 77, you had two milestones. It was your movie debut, but it was when Bleacher Bums was born. How did you come up with that whole
concept?
Well,
that was an idea I had because I'm a huge Cub fan. I mean, it's almost a curse that your father puts on you or your mother, whoever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
But you live with it, and I'm proud to be one. I mean, I love all the Chicago teams, but I was the Cubs are what I started with, and that's who I'll probably go out with.
That's right.
but I used to sit in those bleachers, and I used to think to myself, especially when I started to get into theater, because I was a young actor, like 19, 20 years old, I used to think, what is it about this team that they haven't won a championship since before I was born, and haven't won a championship before my mother was born? I remember
right.
I was born in 1915.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, yet all these thousands of people come to the game. You know, if I could capture that in a theater piece, I've got something. In other words, what is that fandom? What is that thing that constitutes a fan that follows a team that still has not yet fulfilled the ultimate dream? And so luckily I was able to convince the members of the Organic Theater, who I was a member of, that we were looking for a new play to do at that time. And I convinced them that this could be probably a fairly cheap one to do, because all we'd have to do is the costumes would just be what you wear to the ballpark, and we would play the guys.
And some beer.
Yeah, and that was the genesis of it. And luckily, I was with this talented group of people who responded to that, and we created improvisations and whatever the script was created through, and it was really a company contribution. I mean, if you get the script at Samuel French, it'll say conceived by Joe Mantegna, but I share the writing credit with everybody who was involved with that original production, as it should be, because everybody contributed. And the play went on to be to this day is very successful. It gets done all over the world, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Done in Naperville. It's been done. We did it off Broadway. We've done it. Ran in Los Angeles for 10 years when it opened in 1980, and directed by Stuart Gordon and all Keith Sarabica. And yeah, that's something. I mean, it's once in a while things work out. I mean, I don't fancy myself as being a writer or creator of things in that respect. I mean, acting is my day job, but that was one idea that, through the help of everything kind of came together and helped a lot of people that it Bleacher Bums exists, and I'm very proud of that.
Well, it's a true Chicago story, and again, it connects so much to your roots. Now, I know you're a Cubs fan. What are your earliest memories of the Cubs and going to the games at Wrigley?
Oh God! There's photos of me, you know, sitting in front of a black and white television, you know, with like an old mitt watching, you know. And I think this is one photo. I think it's Hank Sowers at bat. So I mean, we're talking about, you know, predating Ernie Banks' first game even. So I've been a Cub fan since I was a little tiny boy, you know. So I have memories of going there with my dad and my grandfather and my brother and sitting in the stands and watching. And I mean, there was one stretch I remember they lost 10 straight, and I thought it was my fault. So it was like, because we didn't go 10 days in a row, but we went, you know, over that course of that summer, we went to, I think, 10 different games, and they lost every single one. And I kept, my dad finally asked me to a game later after that, and I said, you know, I don't think so. He goes, why? I said, I think it's me.
It's all you.
No, it's not you.
But you know what, back then.
I got over that quickly enough, but I realized it wasn't me. We all live in, you know, us, we Cub fans, we live and die by the, you know.
We do.
Cubby blue. You know, it's funny, when they put lights in Wrigley back in 88, the New York Times called me and asked me to write the op-ed page about that, as being the guy who created Bleacher Bums and the Cubs fan. And I think they expected me to basically come out with this whole thing of like, you know, this is terrible, they should not do this, this is the... But then I realized, as I thought about it, and basically that's what the op-ed page talked about, was that, in a way, this is what nostalgia is. Like you say, you want to remember it as it is. But things are going to change. You know, now, the place has lights now. All these kids nowadays, they go to Wrigley Field. They don't know what Wrigley Field is about lights. But guys like myself, our age and stuff, we can say, you know, I remember this ballpark without lights.
I do.
Same thing with music and everything else, clothes, this, that. Without nostalgia, you don't have that shared experience between people of your own kind of age group.
It's true.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
So, I mean, when I hear a certain song from the 60s, I can relate to it, along with the friends of mine that, hey, remember that was our song, you know?
Yeah.
Or my daughter, they'll listen to it and say, oh, yeah, that's that old stuff, you know, from the 60s, and they may like it or not or whatever. But so that those things don't bother me so much, those changes, as long as inherently the thing still, you know, still kids go, they're Cub fans, they go to watch and play ball, whether the place has lights or whether it's got a different scoreboard or this, that, and the other. You try to keep the roots of it and the heart of it intact. But beyond that, sometimes you just got to kind of go with the change and embrace it and move on, you know?
Yep, so true, Joe. Well, we're talking to Chicago's very own Joe Mantegna, and there's much more ahead next on 720 WGN. It's Dave Player on 720 WGN, and we're talking to Chicago's very own Joe Mantegna. So we talked a little bit about the Bleacher Bums and your start in Chicago. Now, you had your movie debut in 77 as well, same year as the Bleacher Bums. It was called The Medusa Challenger, and I didn't know that much about this film. It's a short film. It was shot in the summer of 76 before the Lakeshore Drive S-curve was straightened out.
Right.
It premiered at the Chicago Biograph. Talk about pure Chicago movie
well, it was
here.
A student film. I mean, it started as a student film for a student from Columbia College there. And so Jack Wallace, who's another mainstay of Chicago theater from the old days, he and I, you know, did this film basically as it, and I think it might have been his graduation film that the director had to make, writer-director. And yeah, it was just this beautiful little 20-minute film, and I had a dear friend, Alan Barkas, who ran a recording studio and an ad company in Chicago doing jingles, and I got him to write the theme music for it. And the thing, it became a very, for what it was, it became a very successful little film. Apparently, they played in, for 1 year, they played it in China for some reason. It was one of these things that they sent over as a part of a goodwill type of thing, because it's that kind of a movie, and they said, based on the amount of people who saw it in China, it may have been one of the most watched films in history.
I read that. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, for this short little film, because it's very positive. You know, I played I guess today you would call it a young man with autism, and I can relate to it because I have a daughter with autism.
Mm-hmm.
So here I was playing this young man with autism, and Jack played my uncle, and it all takes place on the bridge, the drawbridge up there off of Ohio Street there, and it's Medusa Challenger was the name of the boat, the concrete boat that would run through there, and it's. Anyway, it's a sweet little movie, and it was a nice way to, you know, like I say, it was just a student film, but yes, indeed, it was the way I started my film career.
But you said it was a student film. Now, here's a list of awards that this film got. It was 77. It got, like, the arts grant from the Illinois Arts Council. It got a blue ribbon from the American Film Festival, a gold plaque from the Chicago International Film Festival, Virgin Islands, San Francisco International Film Festival, selected film for young adults from the American Library Association, Emmy Award from the Chicago chapter of the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. It's on the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and it is now part of the American Film Institute collection. That's
wow. You know, I didn't even know all of that.
Yeah.
But that's great. I mean, like I said, you go into something, as you go into any project, you go in with you see something, you figure this has got something to it. It's got some heart. It's got some says something. And you just hope for the best. You know, you put it out there.
Sure.
So hopefully, you know, people have enjoyed seeing it. And it was a great way to start a career.
Now, the way I discovered you myself, and I was born in 67, so I'm a little bit younger, but I think the first film I ever saw you in was Tom Hanks' 1986 film. I think it was The Money Pit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We were the repair guys, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was one of my first feature films. I had just recently finished doing the play Glengarry Glen Ross, the David Mamet play,
right,
which really launched my career into another kind of level. Off Broadway back in 84, and I think I made that film probably around 85 or 86.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was the beginning of my legit Hollywood kind of movie career.
Right.
And it was great. I mean, to this day, Tom's a good friend. We had actually worked prior to that. I did an episode of
Bosom Buddies. I saw that, of course.
Yeah, so Tom and I had already known each other, so here it was. Yeah. Now we're working together again on this feature film, and to this day, I still, you know, we run into each other. We joke about stuff like that. But
that's cool.
Cool. Money Pit was a fun way to start my feature film career.
Well, one of your groundbreaking performances over the years was in Godfather 3. It was Joey Zaza, and based your character on a couple of real life mobsters like Joe Colombo and John Gotti. It's pretty amazing to play such a key role in one of America's really greatest movie trilogies.
Yeah, again, I mean, I feel very blessed to have been part of that whole thing because, I mean, sure, growing up and becoming a movie buff, as so many of us are, and you, arguably, you know, those first two Godfather films were listed among the greatest films of all time and should be. So just to be asked to be part of that trilogy and to work with Coppola and everybody else connected, Pacino and the mm-hmm. whole thing that goes with it, you know. Yeah, it's something I'll always remember and I'll always feel very, you know, very strong about. I mean, of course, to this day, I'll be in an airport or something. Somebody yell, "Hey, Joey Zaza!" You know?
Is that right? That's great.
It's like one of those things that, depending on who, what project they relate me to.
Yeah, right.
They're gonna address me that way. So, but yeah, that was a wonderful experience and that was a very memorable year.
Well, the movies are endless. Bugsy, Forget Paris, Up Close and Personal, The Last Hitman. What are some of the film roles that you love the most, you know, whether it was the role you played, the story, or the people you worked with?
Yeah, you know, it's a combination of all those things. Sometimes the most innocuous films are most memorable because I've shot maybe three or four films in Italy, and some of them never even got released in this country, but they're memorable to me because I spent time in Italy with my family. I have relatives in Italy that I'm close to. So the whole experience of making the movie was important to me. Then all the stuff I did with David Mamet was very important.
Who's a good friend of yours, yeah.
Very good. We did House of Games. We did Change. We did Homicide. Just those three movies alone were very important to me and very important to my career. Getting to play Dean Martin in the Rat Pack for HBO was a joy for me.
That's right.
Because I admired Dean Martin so much, and I still play all that music constantly in my car. You know, if you sit in my car and I hit the radio, instantly it's going to come up, you know, to some, you know, Seriously Sinatra station. So roles like that, what's funny is, like you mentioned, I'm getting this Lifetime Achievement. I've gotten this Lifetime Achievement Award from the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce.
This week, yeah.
And it forced me to think about it, that, like, wow, yeah, I guess there's no going back. I guess I'm never going to play left field for the Chicago Cubs. This is what I've done for a living. I've done this for over 40 years, and I've been blessed to have done all these different roles and television and film and theater. I've just been very, very blessed because it's something I've wanted to do since I've been 16, and I've been able to do it at a very high level. So that's all been good. I mean, so when you say what are the favorite things, almost every one of them has a pleasant side to it and has something memorable about it, you know.
Yeah, great stuff. Great stuff and great career as well. But here's the big thing, and I think this is where people obviously now know you is on Criminal Minds, and we're going to talk to Joe about his television career of the star of CBS's Criminal Minds with Chicago's very own Joe Mantegna, next on 720 WGN.
And each time I roam, Chicago is calling me home.
Now, how long was it that you've been voicing Fat Tony on The Simpsons? Because that's a whole other audience knows you,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I've been voicing Fat Tony since 1991.
Wow.
Because I remember what had happened is Godfather opened in this Christmas day of 1990. And it was shortly after that, understandably so, because I had played Joey Zaza. Right. I think The Simpsons people thought, well, how perfect, let's get Joey Zaza to play this character Fat Tony, because he's kind of like the equivalent on The Simpsons,
right,
the character
right.
they'd created. But again, I just thought it was going to be a one-shot deal. In other words, they called me up, they said, hey, we got this character Fat Tony, would you like to be interested? I read the script, I thought it was hilarious. It was only their third season of The Simpsons. So I went in, did it, thinking, all right, this will be fun. This seems like a cute little thing. Little did I know. Again, I guess they felt this character seemed to resonate with the Simpson fans and with the writers and all, so they kept writing for him, and they kept asking me, would you still like to do it? I said, you know what? I'd love to do it. I get such a kick out of doing it. I said, I'll gladly do it. So I've been doing it now for, I think it's about 23, 24
yeah,
years.
Yeah, that's crazy. Like once a year you're doing it at least.
Yeah, I do at least. Well, in fact, I think the next episode that I did, I think actually airs in a couple of weeks.
All right. We'll look for that. Yeah, we'll look for that. Do you like doing the voiceover work? Because I know you were in Disney's Cars as well.
Yeah. Well, it's a whole other thing, and yeah, I enjoy it. I do books on tape. I've been doing books on tape for, God, over 20 years as well. And I've done a lot of the late Robert Parker's books. He did the Spencer books, the detective books, where they created that series years ago called Spencer for Hire with Robert Urich. They were all based on these novels by Robert Parker, and I loved those books. And Robert Parker contacted me years ago when he'd heard about what a fan I was of his books, and he asked me to do three of the movies, which we did for A&E, where I played the character as well of Spencer. And so when he passed away and then his wife Joan passed away and they became dear friends of mine, I still to this day continue to do the novels because they've got another writer. Random House picked up another writer who's very good named Ace Atkins, who has the voice of Robert. Mm-hmm. And so I still do those books on tape, as well as I've done many other books on tape in the past. And so, yeah, the voiceover stuff is just, it's another extension of, you know, of what I do and what...
Well, it's interesting work because you don't see, you know, you obviously don't see the actor, so the acting is a little bit different because you've got to really, there's a lot of emotion in these roles.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot like probably what the old radio play was like. Old
right.
Radio
yeah.
theater was like, and that's real enjoyable.
I'm a big fan of Criminal Minds, and folks, if you haven't seen it, you know, you've got only 9 seasons to watch to start catching up. But the series revolves around an elite team of FBI profilers who analyze the country's most twisted criminal minds, anticipating their next moves before they strike again. And the behavioral analysis unit's most experienced agent is your character, David Rossi. And it's one of those edge-of-your-seat shows that takes so many twists and turns. And after 9 seasons on the air, you know, you wonder if the quality continues. They really do, and the storylines are so captivating. It really compels you to find out what's coming up next.
Yeah. Well, we work at it very hard, partly because we represent a real organization. You know, so many shows, you know, they're these fictitious organizations, and so they have kind of the freedom to just do anything and say anything and be anything. We have to represent the real behavior analysis unit of the FBI, and I've been to Quantico twice. I mean, we have people, former FBI agents work with us on the show. So we have a responsibility to do the best we can and to show, you know, to show the kind of work these men and women do. And that's why some people will say, gee, your show, well, we love it. We're huge fans of it. But, boy, sometimes it's so graphic and so powerful and so disturbing. And they go, how are you able to do that every week? And I say, you know what? It's a privilege to do it every week because it has to be that disturbing because we have to portray it as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And for us to do less than that in a way would almost be an insult to the men and women who have to really do this job. So what we try to show is that, look, this is what they have to deal with. This is what, you know, they have to confront every week, every day. You know, we do it, you know, weekly, and we do it as a pretend thing. So how, mm-hmm. why should this thing bother me? You know, I get to go home at night and, you know, and it's all it's still the make-believe version of this real occupation. So we take it very seriously, and it's all about the writing and the actors and everybody involved, the crew. I mean, everybody does their best to make as best the show as good a show as we can, and its longevity is shown that it seems, you know, the public is responding. We're doing as well after 9 years as we've ever done.
Right,
The ratings are still up there, and you know, right. I like the way you look at this, though, is that you know you're really portraying, you know, something from real life, and you want to do that justice, and I think that's pretty cool, pretty honorable.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to have just fans watch the show; it's another thing to have actual FBI agents who are also watching that show. And I'd love to be able for them to walk away and be able to say, "Look, sure, they take some theatrical liberties. You know, we wish we had a jet that was that nice and stuff like
right.
that." But on the other hand, I think for the most part, they can be at least walk away and feel a sense of pride of that. You know what? They are showing how difficult and this job can be, and I think it's caused a lot of people to pursue careers in that field, which you know, I think is a good thing.
Absolutely, and you know what I also like, you know, you joined in the third season, but mm-hmm. really you're the core of the show because, you know, Mandy Patinkin left after a couple years, and sometimes it's a little hard to, you know, when you got an established series to feature. You did it. You were in, and within a couple episodes, you were there right away. I mean, there was no real transition period. I mean,
thank you. I mean, what my feeling was when I asked me to join the show, and it was under kind of quick circumstances where it was, you know, it wasn't like a gradual kind of lead, and I kind of had to jump right in. But I quickly caught up and watched all the previous episodes, and what I came away with is the strength of the ensemble and how good this ensemble was. So I compared it in a way to a baseball team because my feeling was, you know, this is a great team, and they lost one of the position players. I play that position. I'm going to come in, and mm-hmm. hopefully, if I can play this position as well as I hope I can, we shouldn't miss a beat. And that's kind of just what happened. You know, we lost Billy Williams, but Joe Montaigne came in to play left field. So
right there you go. Well, it continues to be a top show Wednesdays at eight Central on CBS. And if you need to catch up, and you can do that on A&E, Bravo, and Ion Television. The encore presentations are all over the place.
Right.
How often are you back in Chicago, Joe?
I usually, you know, because of my work schedule on Criminal Minds, which basically shoots for 10 months out of the year,
mm-hmm.
I have a small window when I can really comfortably get in and out. So I almost always try to come in the months of either May or June.
Well, you can see Joe on Criminal Minds on CBS Wednesdays at 8 Central. And again, if you need to catch up on that, you can do that on A&E, Bravo, and Ion Television, and at CBS.com. And for more on Joe, you can visit his own webpage at joemontaigne.com. Joe, absolute pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure. Always great to talk to the hometown.
All right, and say hello to your brother Ron for me.
I certainly will.
All right, This Week in History coming up next on 720 WGN.